Hello, and welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine podcast series. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is a monthly digest of crime and mystery fiction. To give you a sense of what the magazine is about, we offer podcasts of stories from our back issues. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. In this new installment of our podcast series, Miriam Wilsky Strong reads her story, Death at Olympia, which appeared in our July-August 2003 issue. A teacher and lecturer for the Maryland Humanities Council, Miriam Wilsky Strong is also a prolific short story writer. She's published 9 stories set in ancient Greece for AHMM, as well as stories set in and around Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, where she grew up. And now, just in time for the 2014 Winter Olympics, is Miriam Wilsky Strong reading her story, Death at Olympia.
We arrived at Olympia in Elis 2 days before the full moon, in magnificent weather. Cooling winds had blown over the Olympian plain, dispersing the usually intense heat. The games would be comfortable this year, though as crowded as ever. Tents and huts were sprawled everywhere on the plains and hills surrounding the sacred game area. Already the food vendors had sold a fortune in tuna, anchovies, and even outrageously expensive eels. The acrobats were entertaining the crowds. The painters and sculptors were displaying their art. Vendors, men and women, the latter on pain of death, kept out of the confines of the sacred game area, but on the periphery were doing a brisk business in wool capes and headbands for the cool weather, lucky charms, small votive statues, and sandals, both well and poorly made. Poets and historians were reading their works to anyone who would listen. Merchants and politicians were making deals. Singers were reciting Homer and Hesiod, hoping for paid engagements from the wealthy attendees. Servants and slaves were fetching water from the 9 fresh streams and from the fountain of Pierra. Everyone was relieving himself in the Clatios and Alpheus rivers. A typical beginning for this, the 81st Olympiad, the 8th for me since I began attending with my father at age 10. At this Olympiad, I, Clytie, came as a representative from Athens, along with Pericles, his friend Phidias, who already had a statue of Zeus in planning for the Olympia, Sophocles, who eyed all the athletes, Diocles, a sophist like myself, and Epidides, who hoped someday to rival Phidias's great art. With such company, and even in the absence of Socrates, who, as always, refused to leave Athens, I expected very stimulating talk at the evening symposium in the villa of Pericles' friend Critias, who was providing us all with very comfortable quarters, where we hoped to celebrate a victory of his horses in the chariot race. Even Pericles, who seldom attended symposia, had agreed to attend. I was not disappointed. That evening, after the opening great procession of judges, heralds, and athletes to the altar of Zeus for sacrifices and oaths not to take bribes or attempt victory by unfair means, we argued about the purpose of the games. Critias, no supporter of our Athenian democracy despite his friendship with Pericles, criticized what he saw as the growing commercialism and corruption of the games. "We let anyone participate now," he lamented, signaling for his servant to pour more fine Chian wine into our cups. "The purpose of the games is not to entertain. It is to prepare men for warfare." "But that is still the case," Pericles argued. "Only now all male citizens help defend their city-state, not just those who can afford armor. If all our male citizens are needed to defend the state, then all should participate in what prepares them for that defense. They should take pride in all that Athens does and in all it can achieve. All Athenians should strive for perfect beauty of body and manly virtue of soul. Perhaps the common man can run or wrestle or throw the discus as well as any of aristocratic birth, Critias argued, but the common man is a specialist, not like Callias, who won 12 of the wrestling and boxing matches on the game circuit. And look what has happened since we let all male citizens participate. The race in full armor has become a matter for laughter. Pericles chuckled. You must admit it can be funny. All that clanging and tripping and bumping. Not funny, Critias mumbled into his cup of wine. Next thing, we'll be letting women participate. Bad enough we have the Heraea, that damned race for girls. Give them all of branches and everything. Pericles smiled. Well, my dear Critias, perhaps if they run well, we should allow women in the games. I knew that Pericles uttered this heresy only to tease Critias, but I was thankful that everyone here was a friend of Pericles. His enemies would have seen his statement as proof of the influence his beautiful mistress Aspasia had on him. I expressed the idea that talent should be nurtured in all classes, then turned to Sophocles to get his opinion. But he hadn't been listening. He was absorbed in a picture Epidides had sketched on a waxed surface. A magnificent boy, he said, leaning over the edge of his couch to look over Epidides' left arm. So slender, so graceful, so fluid, as if the arm and leg joints themselves floated in olive oil. A lovely straight forehead and full lips. I must know who he is. I don't know his name, Epidides said. I saw him today, watching the practice for the stadion. Ah, the stadion, Sophocles sighed. In my opinion, the most beautiful of the sports. The runners are long-limbed, but not too long. They are neither too tall, like the discus throwers, nor too short or heavy, like the wrestlers. Their shoulders and hips are symmetrical, their buttocks small and in proportion with their backs. They are beautiful. So it is a crime that you have drawn this youth with a cape wrapped round his torso. Why? Because he wore that cape when I saw him. I wanted to draw him as I saw him. Later I will draw him nude. I'm hoping to see him again if he participates in the boys' races. If not here, then at Delphi. I would go just to see him. I judge him to be perhaps 12 or 14, old enough to participate, and to learn from his brother. His brother, Sophocles said, sitting upright so fast he almost spilled his wine and upset his plate of eels and olives. Then you do know who he is. I know who he is. I said that I do not know his name. A man at the stadium practice said that he must be the younger brother of Aptimus of Melos. I stopped in the midst of raising a bit of honeyed bread to my mouth. Aptimus? Ah, yes. I have heard his name again and again today. At the vendors, at the fountain, at the treasuries. Today, while athletes were presenting their offerings at the treasure houses, they talked of Aptimus. They say that his running technique is utter perfection, even better than before his injury 2 years ago. They say that he moves his arms like wings, and that he has learned to move from the balls of his feet with his torso gently forward, as if he were a young girl dancing. But who is his trainer? Pericles had stopped arguing with Critias and was listening to our conversation. His father, or so I was told, Epidides said, holding out his drawing to Phidias. His father, Xanthias? Pericles exclaimed. Hard to believe. Why? I asked. His father won the stadium once. I drank the last of my wine and smiled at the painting in my cup of Atalanta, the female runner in the old myth. Oh, yes, and I believe the older daughter won the Herera once. Yes, Pericles said, but that was some years ago, and the father was a runner of strength, not grace. How would he have taught his son to run like a dancer? Who knows, Sophocles said, shrugging. But if we have Aptimus and this young brother of his to watch, I intend to be at Delphi, Corinth, Nemea, and Olympia for all the games. Pericles smiled. but you will be very busy in Athens, my friend. We all expect another play as great as Antigone was a year ago. We want to know if you feel that democracy can be as efficient as tyranny." Pericles had loved the play because one of the characters spoke for democracy. "Well," Sophocles began, "a tyranny..." My friend Diocles rushed into the room, nearly knocking over a servant who had just carried in a plate of goat cheese, artichokes, and honeyed garlic. "I've just heard the most extraordinary gossip," he said with his usual hyperbole. "The most extraordinary? Truly, Diocles?" I was about to ask him to define extraordinary, as the increasingly inquisitive Socrates would have asked, but Diocles rushed on. "We must be living in the most corrupt age ever," he announced. "I've just heard that one of the judges, a judge of the Stadion, has been accused of charges of bribery." We were all struck silent. This was indeed extraordinary. Not that judges had never before accepted bribes, but it was rare indeed. The judges took very seriously their oath before the altar of Zeus to refuse any bribe and to keep secret the reason for their decisions. "A judge from where?" Pericles asked, sitting up and swinging his legs down to the mosaic floor. I knew how much he cared for the honor and glory of Athens. "Not from Athens. Our council chose our judges well. But the judge in question is one of the most knowledgeable, Tysander of Corinth. He denies the charges." "Ah, Corinth, of course, a corrupt city," Sophocles pronounced. "But a city of the most beautiful prostitutes in all of Hellas," Phidias declared. "Ah," I said, "so beauty and virtue do not necessarily live within the same vessel. But this is no time to argue the point." "Who made the charge against Tysander?" I asked Diocles. "The Spartan delegation. They say that one of their judges saw Tysander on the hill of Kronos, behind the treasure houses, talking with an athlete." "Of course, Tysander is known for talking to many of the athletes, even before the games. He knows many of the athletes well. He travels about a good deal to see the top athletes." Pericles lay back on his couch. "Well, the charges may be true," Phidias said. "The Spartans are crude and entirely lacking in artistic taste, but they are honest." "Or at least not clever enough to be dishonest," I said, sophist that I was. "I presume the Eleans will investigate." "Indeed, the men of Elis pride themselves on keeping the games pure. But," Diocles said, accepting a cup of wine from a servant, "that is not all. There is even worse news." "More extraordinary than the most extraordinary, my friend?" I asked. "Yes, indeed," Diocles said. He took a sip of wine. "The Spartans say that some statues of fine Scythian gold are missing from their treasury. Stolen, they say, a day or two ago, when the practices were at their most intense, and a Spartan got careless with his guard duty. He has already been sent back to Sparta." "Do the Spartans have any idea who stole the statues?" I asked. "The Spartans blame the judge Tysander. They say if he would accept bribes, he would also steal." "Ah, Spartan logic," I said. "You see," Critias said, turning to Pericles, "the games have been corrupted. This is what comes of your democracy. If one does not have a long, honorable family history, one cannot have honor." "Ah, aristocratic logic," Pericles said. "Well, tomorrow should prove most interesting. Everyone will be at the opening chariot races. We shall no doubt hear many theories about the theft. You, as usual, Clytus, will keep your counsel until you hear all the theories." "Until I know more," I said, "much more. Facts, not theories." "Well," Sophocles said, "I shall look for this young man at the practice for the Stadion." He picked up Epidiotis' drawing and stared at it. "Beautiful," he murmured. Pericles smiled. "Beauty, as Socrates claims, should be won with virtue. But beauty, in whatever form, is irresistible. That is why the bribery charge, if true, is more serious than the theft. the athlete who runs with the greatest beauty of form, not just distance, must win. Nothing must interfere with the judging of the beauty of form. I took the picture from Sophocles and studied the slender arms and legs of the young athlete wrapped in his cloak. I decided that I, too, would look for the young man tomorrow. 38 chariots raced on the second day of the 81st Olympiad. For 12 laps of the hippodrome, the chariots raced, colliding and scraping, with the horses sweating and foaming, and the hubs of the wheels just clearing the turning posts. We Athenians roared when the trumpeter blew for the last one-half lap, and Critias's chariot flew toward the finishing post. We knew the judges would confirm his victory, for from the moment the bronze eagle was swung into the air to start the race, Critias's chariot leapt from its part of the starting gate as if driven by Helios, the sun god himself. Pericles clapped me on the back. Diocles and I raised our fists to the skies. Epidides threw down his stylus and wooden tablet and clasped his hands over his head. Another Athenian, a commoner in spite of Critias's opinions, won the pentathlon, taking 3 events, the discus, the javelin throw, and the long jump. Our hopes for a clean sweep of the day's events had been dashed in the late morning when a Spartan won the horse race, but we all agreed that anyway, the celebration at Critias's villa that evening would be a feast fit for the gods. Phidias declared his intent to sting Critias's aristocratic conservatism with the commoner's pentathlon victory, but Pericles, ever even-tempered and well-mannered, cautioned him against provoking our host too much. I decided to buy a gift for my mistress Selkine and for Lamachus, my 2-year-old nephew, before I headed over to see the stadium practice. Pericles accompanied me to the vendor's area to buy something for Aspasia. He bought a brooch, a flower fashioned of gold with touches of blue enamel on the petals, a blue that would match the blue-black of Aspasia's eyes and hair. Lacking Pericles' money, I parted from my friend and wandered over to the area of less expensive vendors. I found a terracotta pig with pebbles inside, just perfect for my nephew Lamachus to drive his father mad with the noise. I made my way through the crowds of men to a vendor selling headbands. I was rifling through the headbands hanging from a pole, trying to decide between a blue or a red one, when the man next to me gave the vendor half an obol and stepped aside to make room for the next customer. I recognized the customer immediately. The slender arms and legs, the perfect forehead, were unmistakable. It was the boy of Epidides' drawing. He reached for a headband of gold and blue, a lovely one, that could grace the head of a goddess. I watched as he lifted the headband to gaze at the dyes, checking, I presumed, to see how evenly they flowed through the wool. His slim fingers stroked the material until, apparently feeling my gaze upon him, he turned his head to me, gave me a sharp look, dropped the headband, turned, and pulling his cloak tighter about himself, moved away, his long, powerful strides breaking easily and speedily through the crowd. I understood Epidides' artistic interest in the boy, and for a moment I even understood Sophocles' more prurient interest. I quickly purchased the blue headband per Selkine, but by the time the vendor took my half-opal, the boy had disappeared. I made my way back into the altis, past its temples, up by the treasury houses, noticing that the Spartan house was now well guarded by 5 armored men. At the stadium, I watched the practices, noting the beauty with which Aptimus ran. I watched the narrow entrance arch to the stadium carefully, but Aptimus's young brother did not show up. I spent the rest of the day listening to some rather mediocre poetry, regretting that Pindar was too ill to attend the games. No one could match his great odes to past Olympians. His tribute to the never-tiring hooves of Theron's winning horses in the chariot races, to the splendor of Ergotides' long-distance run, to Aegisthus, who ran like a hound flying across the hills. I gossiped about the decadent Persians and the Great Pyramids, as Herodotus described them, and which I hope to see someday myself. As I gossiped, I turned the talk inexorably to the current scandals. Tysander, gossip had it, was arrogant and extravagant, but knowledgeable about the runners and scrupulous about his judging. By the end of the day, I found out that the Spartans had dropped the charges against Tysander, and the Elians had identified Gigos of Aegina, a graceful but unsuccessful runner, as the thief of the Spartan statues. Everyone was shocked, since Gigos had been training with Aptimus and had improved his form and speed. Now he had disappeared from Olympia in disgrace, perhaps cynical, angry, and unwilling to bear yet another defeat at the games, particularly after his intensified training. I made my way to the Alpheus River to wash, refreshed myself with a clay jar of water purchased from a vendor, and started for the celebration at Critias's villa, assuming that the scandals were over and the purity of the games preserved. I was wrong. We feasted through half the night on succulent eels, poppy seed loaves dipped in rich olive oil, roasted garlic, and the ultimate delicacy, a sow's womb. Of course, Critias also provided abundant Chian wine. He and Pericles continued to debate who should participate in the games. Critias fretted over the gifts given to successful athletes, the freedom from taxes, the free meals on the state for a year, and the vases of olive oil. He maintained that the olive wreath given at Olympia should be enough. Pericles argued that the athletes should be rewarded for their hard work, and I argued that pride and the desire for fame could corrupt as easily as the desire for wealth. We were enjoying the talents of some flute girls when again Diocles burst in, his cheeks practically exploding with the news he had held inside while he'd run up to the villa. "What is it now?" Critias, annoyed by the interruption, asked. "The most..." Diocles stopped and looked at me. "It is truly extraordinary, Clytie. An athlete has been murdered." His face drooped with the release of his news, then perked up with pride at being the carrier of such dramatic news. We all sat still, shocked. The games were sacred. All were guaranteed safe passage to the games, and all were forbidden to bring arms. "Who was murdered?" Pericles asked, calm as usual. "Cleon of Aegina, another runner, a talented runner." I sat up. The flute girl I'd been holding gripped my arm. "Murdered how? Where?" I asked. Diocles lifted his hands. "I don't know where. Some men found him. He was floating in the Clatios River." "Probably drowned then," Critias said. "Too much drinking to celebrate the start of the games. Even athletes drink too much these days." "No, no," Diocles said. "He has been dead for several days. His head, the back of his head, it was bashed in. Everyone believes that it was Gigos, the thief of the statues, who must have done it. Perhaps Cleon realized that Gigos was planning to steal the statues, and so Gigos killed him. It is logical." Pericles rose. "What is logical is not always true. We must seek the truth. We are Greeks, all of us, here at Olympia. We cannot allow such a crime to go unpunished. We cannot allow any crime here, even the theft of Spartan statues, to go unpunished." Phidias shrugged. "No great crime," he muttered. "Maybe not up to your artistic standards, Phidias," Diocles said, "but apparently statues of high quality Scythian gold." Pericles ignored them both. Clytie, you have found the truth of such matters for us in the past. You must do it again. I nodded. But this was Olympia, not Athens. I had thousands of suspects. I decided to start with the Spartan delegation and Tysander of Corinth. This collection of scandals involving the Stadion could not be coincidence alone. The next day, we all attended the great sacrifice to Zeus. The procession was magnificent. With the judges and priests in purple and white robes, the mound of ashes glowing on Zeus's altar, the bulls bellowing before their sacrifice, the burning meat filling the air with a thick odor. We would all eat well at the victory celebrations when the games ended. In the early afternoon, after a light snack of bread from a vendor, I made my way up to the treasure houses. The Spartan guards refused to speak to me, but the Athenians, the Corinthians, and the Thebans were brimming with gossip, most of it useless. One Corinthian gave me a solemn bit of information. He said that he'd been told by a Spartan guard that the careless guard had never made it back to Sparta. He'd been executed that morning. I prowled around the Spartan camps to confirm the information. I was well aware of the harshness of the Spartans, but this, even for them, seemed excessive. I started to add up the incidents. Tysander had been seen near the treasure houses. Gold statues had been stolen from the Spartan treasure house. The Spartans had accused Tysander of accepting a bribe because he had met with an athlete on the hill near the treasure houses. But what if it had not been Tysander, but the Spartan guard who had accepted a bribe to turn his head the other way when the robbery took place? It was rare for Spartan guards to take bribes, but even rarer, given their training, to be careless. It seemed to me that the guard in question might well have been bribed. This disgrace, given the Spartan accusation against Tysander and the Spartan reputation for honesty, would account for why the Spartans had dropped the bribery charge against Tysander and executed the guard. I decided to test my idea. I sought out whatever Spartan delegation member looked as if he'd drunk too much wine the night before and encouraged him to talk about the horse race and the horse wind who had won. As always, the Spartans turned garrulous when talking about their own strength or the strength of their horses. After a while, I slipped in a comment on the stolen statues and the guard taking a bribe. Most of the Spartans shut up fast, but one asked how I knew the guard had been executed for his crime. Not wanting to implicate the Corinthian guard who had given out the information, I said that the Elians had let it out. The Elians, in charge of the games, pretty much knew everything that went on anyway, so I figured the Spartan would accept my story. I headed again to the stadium. The boys' races were on that afternoon, and I hoped to see Epidides' young racer in action. Besides, if Tysander were judging that race, I might get a chance to talk to him, though I couldn't think of any way of asking if he'd taken a bribe, bribed a guard, or killed the Aegean runner without having him punch me in my eyes. I was disappointed that the young runner wasn't there, and rather puzzled as to why he wasn't. But I didn't think about it too much, at least not then. I saw Tysander standing among the other purple-robed judges. I watched the races, pleased to see that we would have fine racers for the next Olympiad. Once the winners had been announced and the palm leaves awarded, I pushed through the crowd to talk to Tysander. He had sharp, pugnacious eyes, and a long nose that bulged out at the nostrils. He had the look of an intelligent wrestler, but the paunch that bulged slightly from beneath his robe gave away his indulgent nature. His eyes told me that he might be fairly easily provoked, so I started with a harmless question. I started by asking him about Aptimus's little brother, but he just shrugged. "Yes, there is a younger brother," he said, eyeing the big olives a vendor was selling. "He is not competing." I suppose you've heard about Cleona Vagina, I said.
Of course, everyone's heard.
Did you know him? Tysander eyed the olives again, then pulled out a pouch. He dug inside and extracted a Melian coin, dropped it back inside, and extracted a Corinthian coin. The vendor asked for an Athenian coin. Tysander growled something about not understanding why only Athenian coins were widely accepted, since everyone knew the Athenian reputation for deception. I bit my tongue. So you knew, Cleon, I said. Tysander glared. But of course, as a judge of the Stadion, I would know him, as would the other judges. Tysander sniffed at his olives, his nostrils bulging out even more. He picked up one of the olives. What did you think of him? Tysander dropped the olive back into the cup. You want to know what he was like? He was superstitious, like all the athletes. He turned and strode away. You knew Gigos, didn't you? I yelled. Was he the athlete you were talking to on the hill of Kronos? He turned. I thought he was going to throw his olives at me. I thought maybe you could help to recover the statues, I said, trying to sound innocent. Of course I knew Gigos, you empty storage jar. And I have talked to him and other athletes here at the games and elsewhere. I have watched them practice from the hill of Kronos, from near the treasuries, and from every other part of Olympia. As for the statues, let the Spartans solve their own problems. He swung around again and stalked off. I sighed. It would be as hard to trap Tysander as it would be to hold an eel. Tysander had covered his tracks well by producing enough tracks to justify his presence anywhere. Knowing that many of the athletes were superstitious, I decided to go down by the river where the seers had their tents set up to see if any of them knew anything about Cleon. Athletes, trainers, spectators all lined up to consult the seers, some out of superstition, some out of any desperate means to assure a successful bet on the athletic events. I didn't put much stock in seers, but I knew that they were an observant lot. Their reputations depended upon it. I wasn't unsympathetic. Mine did, too. Looking among the many seers Cleon had consulted, for one who would talk, cost me 6 opals, a full drachma, and an earful of nonsense about my future love life, my future economic life, and my future health. One seer told me that a beautiful woman would soon dote on me. I gave him 2 opals. I knew that Pericles would reimburse me and more. After all, he didn't know that I was hoping, no doubt futilely, that the beautiful woman would be Aspasia. At least, I don't think he knew. I finally found the right man, a thin fellow, but with impressively bushy eyebrows, round eyes, and tufts of hair that gave him the look of an owl. Rather an asset, I thought, to his profession. He was from Melos, Aptimus's home. He threw some wooden dice with letters carved into them to tell me that I would father 7 sons. My mistress Selkene would have shoved the dice into his ears. Then, in answer to my question, he gazed into a terracotta bowl of water to tell me that Aptimus would win the Stadion. Given all the talk about Aptimus's ability, my little nephew Lamachus could have told me that. I pretended to be impressed, produced my last 2 obols, and asked if he had spoken with Cleon of Aegina. He consulted me, yes. The seer sighed. I foresaw his death. I swallowed a large dose of sarcasm. I didn't care about any after-the-fact claims of foreknowledge, but I didn't want to offend the seer. I wanted information. Did you? I said, trying to sound impressed. What had Cleon come to consult you about? Whether or not he would win the Stadion. And you predicted he would not? Of course. I saw his death in the waters. He gestured to the terracotta bowl. I didn't think anybody could see much in that water besides some dirt. The only death one could have predicted might have been that of the poor little dead bug that floated on the water. You are skilled indeed to have seen his death in those waters, I said, keeping a straight face.
I can see why Cleon consulted you. I thought I could feel oil gathering on my tongue. Was he worried about dying when he came in to you?
No, no, the seer said, shifting on the rope chair on which he sat. With his right hand, he flicked the bug out of the bowl, trying to cover the action with his left hand. He was worried about losing the stadium.
Did you tell him Aptimus would win?
Indeed, I did. I told him that unless Aptimus fell ill or hurt himself or was disqualified, he would win. I told him that Aptimus was in perfect health.
Did that upset Cleon?
The seer shrugged.
Well, of course, but I assured Cleon that he would win at the Delphian game, provided he had the right charms and prayers.
I looked at the bundles of herbs, the rabbit's feet, and the poorly made statues of the god Hermes, and wondered how much Cleon had paid, and how much he wanted to see Aptimus injured.
Had he fought with Aptimus? Had Aptimus killed him? Or was the gossip right? Had Cleon discovered Gigos's plans for theft and died for his discovery?
I was a bit discouraged. The seer hadn't yet given me much useful information.
Did you and Cleon talk of anything else or anyone else? I asked.
The seer shook his head.
Not of an athlete, no.
I perked up.
Of whom, then?
He shrugged again. It is difficult to remember.
Let me help your memory, I said. You spoke of Tysander of Corinth.
I was guessing, of course, but I was damn sure of my guess. Perhaps another obol or two would help you remember what was said.
The seer smiled and accepted the coins.
Cleon told me that Tysander knew of some possible violation by Aptimus that would disqualify him from the Olympics and worse. He wanted to know if I could see the violation to verify it.
And? The seer shrugged. I told him that I felt something, that perhaps Aptimus was not born of both a Greek mother and father.
It was a standard guess. I didn't believe it. If Tysander suspected something about Aptimus, that something had to be much more grave, grave enough for him to have Cleon try to verify it.
Did Cleon tell you what the supposed violation was?
The seer looked disgruntled.
No. He said he came to get information, not to give it.
So, I thought, Tysander didn't want the slander made public. Why not? I would have to talk with Aptimus and with Tysander again, though I doubted that I would get much out of him.
I wandered about again and found that Aptimus and his father were staying not at the bathhouses, but at the home of a friend across the Alpheus River. I knew better than to try to talk to Aptimus the evening before the stadium, so I headed for Critias's villa for more feasting. I took a circuitous route up past the bathhouses, where many of the athletes stayed, keeping my eyes open just in case Tysander was still wandering about. I walked up past Hera's temple and the precinct of the earth goddess Demeter, where a priestess, the only female allowed at the games, chanted her prayers. The taboo against females at the games was very strict. Aspasia thought the taboo foolish. I spotted Phidias, who was lecturing on the perfect proportions for statues of athletes. I didn't think Tysander would be interested enough to be here, so I wandered on, making my way along the Cladios River, where some of the most costly vendors had set up shop. I had guessed correctly. Tysander was still shopping. I followed at a discreet distance, ready to move up fast if he pulled out his pouch of money. I wanted to see as much as I could of the variety of coins he carried. He found a vendor of jars and examined several oil jars and perfume flasks. Finally, he seemed to settle on a lovely powder jar, lustrous black, with a lovely figure of a kneeling girl washing her hair. Unheeding of the accusations of being a stinking bore, I shoved my way through the crowd to Tysander's left side to get a clear view of his hands. I couldn't be entirely sure, but the coin he offered the vendor appeared to be from Aegina, Cleon's home. The vendor rejected the coin,
just as the olive seller had rejected the Melian coin. Tysander had quite a collection of coins. I was pretty sure I knew why. My guess was that he offered information to the athletes, for a price, of course. How a given athlete practiced, how another raced, what made one nervous and another angry, what violations might disqualify a rival. I wondered if Cleon had been able to verify Tysander's suspicions about Aptimus, and if that verification had put Cleon, now knowing too much, in danger. I wondered, too, if Tysander had sold the thief Gigos the information that one of the Spartan guards could be bribed to look the other way, or if he had bribed both athlete and guard to do his dirty work. The vendors were closing up shop as the sun set over the Cladios River, gilding the columns of Hera's temple. I headed for Critias's villa. The Stadion race proved most exciting. Aptimus raced gloriously, his body glistening with oil and powder, his long legs lifting gracefully off the balls of his feet, his arms swinging up and back so rhythmically they seemed indeed like wings. Three other racers nipped at his back for a time, but he soared ahead twice to win the stod and the double stod, running the two lengths of the stadium as easily as he had run the single length. With Aptimus's father leading the way, the Melians lifted the athlete to their shoulders for a run down the stadium. They cheered wildly, as we all did. So beautiful was Aptimus's form. After the races, remembering that I had a task, I asked Sophocles if he had spotted the young brother. Not as interested in the race as myself, he had kept a sharp eye out for the young man, who had, Sophocles said, hung back near the edge of the crowd jammed on the hill of Kronos. But the young brother had disappeared. I looked for Tysander at the Pancratian, figuring that the biting, gouging, wrestling, and boxing event would appeal to him, but he had disappeared too. Seeing that I had little chance of even approaching Aptimus in his triumph, I decided to go over to the home where Aptimus and his family were staying. I headed to the Alpheus River to hire a boatman to take me across. I had no idea what I would ask the young brother when I found him, but I realized that his apparent desire for solitude was troubling, and that he might know something about Cleon's search for Aptimus's supposed violation. I paid for my passage across the river and made my way on the path up the hills above the spot where the two rivers meet. The waters of the wilder Cladios River flowed swiftly down a gorge, sliding over clumps of rocks and racing toward the meeting point with the Alpheus. Sniffing the odor of pine and wild olive trees, I stood for several moments staring down into the gorge, an idea forming in my mind. I thought of Epidite's sketch of the young athlete, of the headband of many colors that I had seen him purchase, and of the painting in my wine cup at the symposium. I sat on a clump of grass, horrified. If what I now suspected were true, I faced a most difficult decision. The games had already been violated by murder. Were they violated in another way? If so, I had an obligation to reveal it. Otherwise, I could fall into disgrace. I thought of Epidite's sketch again. I thought about my mistress Selkene, and I thought about Aspasia and how she might react. I stood up, wiping perspiration from my face, though the sun was mild and the breeze cooling. I turned toward Olympia, determined now to pursue the matter no further. But I could see the stadium in the distance, and the Temple of Hera with its old and stately columns, and I remembered that Tysander had also disappeared after Aptimus had won the stod. I feared now for the life of the young athlete, if what I suspected was true. I had to find Tysander and the athlete. I hurried along the path, rising higher up the gorge, knowing now why Aptimus and his father had chosen to stay at a spot distant from the bathhouses and the crowds in the valley. Here and there, poppies were still in bloom, their blood-red petals waving gently in the breeze. I could smell bitter rue in the air, and from the valley below, I could hear in the distance the shouts of triumph and celebration from the games. Had they been so violated that the gods would be angry? I reminded myself that I was a sophist, that rain and thunder were natural occurrences, not the revenge of Zeus, that eclipses, as Pericles always pointed out, hurt no one, and meant only that one heavenly body had passed before another, as one might pass a cloak before one's eyes and blot out the light. I still could not see the villa and slowed to get my bearings. I could not afford to lose my way, though neither, if my guess was right, did I have time to spare. Ahead the path seemed to curve and disappear into a grove of plane trees. I glanced toward the river to check direction and stopped in my tracks. I was face to face with a young man who had emerged from the grove of trees at the edge of the gorge. It was Gigos of Aegina. He stared at me wild-eyed, then leapt into a fast run, moving over the path and around the curve as if his very life depended on it. I stood for a moment with my mouth open, but no words emerged, an unenviable situation for a sophist. I had expected to see Tysander up here, not Gigos, his partner in theft, but I was sure that I was still right about the danger to the young athlete. Perhaps death had already struck. I had little hope of catching Gigos, so I turned toward the gorge. I cut through the trees and stopped when I spotted a figure sitting, bent over, at the edge of the gorge. I crept closer, treading as lightly as possible on the dry undergrowth. Here and there, I snapped a twig and sent a small stone rolling toward the gorge, but the bent figure showed no signs of having heard me. Perhaps the sobbing covered my noises. I listened to the sobs, heart-rending gulps of sorrow breaking from the figure's throat. Fear, I thought, fear of discovery and death. I approached, my mind swirling with plans to avert death. Perhaps I can help, I said softly from 10 footsteps away, hoping to lessen the fear I knew the figure would feel upon my appearance. The athlete jumped up and whirled to face me. I looked into the large, deep brown eyes of a woman, the proportion of whose high, broad forehead and beautifully rounded chin were as beautiful as the mythical Atalanta. "Don't be frightened," I said, "at least not of me. I am from Athens, not Sparta, where women are freer, but I won't betray you. You are Aptimus's trainer, aren't you? Not your father. And you wanted, understandably, to see your brother's victory." She nodded and wrapped her arms round her shoulders as if to protect herself. "Are you hurt?" I asked. She shook her head. The gold glinted in the blue headband, a headband Selkany would have loved. "No," she said in a low voice, "but now it is too late. I am doomed." She lifted a slender arm and gestured toward the gorge. "No," I said, "no one but Tysander and Gigos know that you, a female, violated the sacred games by your presence. But I can stop them from revealing your sex. I know that they are thieves and Tysander a bribe taker." She shook her head vigorously. "No," she said, "he is not a thief. Gigos is not a thief. Not really." My mouth opened again and shut. I gave myself time to think. "He, with Tysander, stole the Spartan statues, did they not?" I thought some more. "No, not with Tysander. For Tysander, to protect you." She nodded and kept her head down, looking miserably at the gorge. "Tysander found out about you, didn't he? And he threatened to reveal your presence unless you helped him steal those Scythian gold statues, didn't he?" She nodded again. "But why did Gigos—" I stopped. Of course, I saw it now. Gigos had trained with Aptinus and fallen in love with his sister, a graceful, beautiful runner in her own right. So Gigos did it for you, because if you had gotten caught, it would have meant instant death. I was ashamed to admit that only then did it occur to me why Gigos had raced away from the gorge. I stepped to the edge and looked down. Tysander's body lay crumpled on the rocky edge of the Cladios River. "So he came up here to get the statues from Gigos," I said. "And knowing Tysander, he asked for more." "He asked for me," the girl said, her head coming up with pride and dignity. I thought of Aspasia. "Swine belly," I muttered, "and so Gigos pushed him over the gorge." "No, I did." I, a sophist, was shocked. "By all the gods! And Gigos left you, ran away?" "I sent him to get Aptimus so that we could all escape. I was to go to the house where we are staying, but I could not leave immediately. I killed a man here." She looked at the gorge. I stared at her in admiration. We in Athens recognize that one must sometimes kill to defend oneself. Most Athenians would not have recognized this woman's right to defend herself, but I was not among most Athenians. Neither was Pericles. He had a fine sense of justice. Very fine. He would help. But I needed to know one more thing. "Cleon of Aegina? Tysander set him upon you, didn't he?" I said. "Tysander perhaps recognized you from your days in the Herera, and he sent Cleon around to consult a dozen seers to see if anyone else knew about you, since blackmail works only with a secret. Then he sent Cleon where you were staying to verify that indeed you were here." She sighed. "Yes, at night, Cleon came to the river where Aptimus and I were practicing. My father was there, too. He fought with Cleon to save me. He killed him. And when Cleon didn't return to report to Tysander, Tysander knew that his guess was correct." The girl held her head and sobbed again. "He said he would bring charges against my father. My father is old and ill. He will not survive this horror." "But you will," I said. "Come, I have a good friend who will see to it that you get safe passage to one of our colonies. He will see to it, too, that Gigos is sent to be with you." I looked toward the gorge. "I will convince everyone that Tysander committed suicide because I discovered that he was the thief. I am a sophist. I can talk of the evidence of his coins until everyone is so confused that they cannot think about the matter any longer. Except for Pericles. We will, of course, tell him the truth. He will be satisfied with nothing less." Pericles listened quietly. When I finished, he sat, still quiet, for a few moments. "She is safe enough for now," he asked finally. "No one knows enough to attack her, physically or verbally." I knew that he was thinking of the attacks on Aspasia, accusations of everything from running a brothel to procuring women for Pericles. "Yes," I said, "their host has protected the family and will continue to do so. He will help." Pericles looked pleased. "Then all will be well. Aspasia has many friends yet in Ionia. The girl and her lover will be safe there. And you, Clytie? Can you expose Tysander's bribery and theft?" "No, not without endangering Aptimus's family. But I can do something. You see, the Spartan guard was paid in Corinthian coins, the coins of Tysander's city. I will spread that word. The Spartans will not admit openly that one of their guards took a bribe, but they will not contradict me, particularly since I can retrieve the gold statues. And I will spread word of Tysander's inexplicable collection of coins of many cities. I can make the implications clear. It will be enough to discredit him." Pericles smiled. "And so the winner of the stud was trained by a female. A pity we cannot tell Critias."
That was Marianne Wilsky Strong reading her story, Death at Olympia, from the July-August 2003 issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is published 10 times a year by Dell Magazines. To learn more about us, we urge you to go to our website, themysteryplace.com, or look for us on Facebook. You can find the magazine at your newsstand. Digital versions are now available from Amazon, Apple, Barnes & Noble, Magster, Sony, and on Google Play for your Android. This podcast was produced with the help of Jackie Sherbo and Deanna McLafferty. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Thanks for listening.